From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made with a series of emails. Local writer and a music critic you know, a WXXI contributor now, we're proud to claim him, Jeff Spivak, was working on a book about the life of a sailor, a man named Ernie Coleman. Ernie was 93 years old when the two men were working on this project. Ernie was a child of the Great Depression, a Navy veteran, and a champion racer who guided boats all around Lake Ontario. The book called Chasing the Wind was meant to be a biography of this seemingly ordinary man, but as Jeff came to learn, Ernie's life was not ordinary. And in some ways, you could say he participated in the shaping of history. During his time in the Navy, Ernie worked as a carpenter aboard the USS Vincennes. The cruiser was part of the Guadalcanal campaign in the South Pacific, particularly at the Battle of Tsavo Island. The 22-minute fiery battle with the Japanese was devastating for the U.S. Navy. In fact, the worst open-sea defeat in the Navy's history. More than 300 of Ernie's crewmates on the Vincennes were lost, and for decades after the battle, he said he could still hear their screams as they perished in the burning water. He had nightmares. The memories were too vivid for Ernie, too painful, and so he pushed them aside and refused to talk about the battle that haunted him. But back to that series of emails I mentioned. Jeff was struggling to write about the Vincennes, and Ernie's family was struggling with how to address it with him. They began to notice the sailor experiencing nightmares. Ernie's wife emailed Jeff saying, quote, "It seems that just talking about it has opened some very deep wounds and memories that have set off some nightmares keeping him awake at night. He said he did not want the name of the ship in it, as he did not want people to ask him about it, as it brings up images that he had buried a long time ago. He said it wakes him up, and he could still hear some of the guys crying out in the water and images that he cannot even face today," end quote. Ernie Coleman never opened up about the Vincennes to Jeff Spivak, not really. But Chasing the Wind was published and it was a success. But the question of how to tell the story of the tragedy without the voice of the man who survived it remained. And it became the focus of Jeff's newest book, 22 Minutes, just released. Jeff is joining us in studio to talk about how 22 Minutes came together and to share the story of, in his words, a common man in uncommon circumstances, a man who was haunted by a water battle but who found solace in the lake. As Jeff told us at Connections, quote, "I wonder how many people are quietly living their lives while holding some terrible tragedies." Jeff, the book is beautiful. I wish I knew Ernie. I know you did, the late Ernie Coleman, and I suspect there's a lot of people who knew him who are proud of this book. How do you feel about it?
How do I feel about the book?
Yeah.
I'm proud of the book. And people who knew Ernie, as you mentioned, he was quite a celebrity on Lake Ontario as a sailor. Everybody on the lake knew him. And he lived in Somerville. And, the people I talked to were just like, Ernie was just this normal guy, average guy, that you would never know held the secret of being a part of a terrible naval battle. And the problem I had was when I first started talking to him about it, which was, I think, in 2010 or 2012, our first conversation, we did talk about it. And he told me about, he understood how soldiers could come home from Afghanistan and Iraq and shoot themselves because the reality of what they had been through was so intense. And if you think about being on a ship that is burning furiously, a ship that's about a football field long sinking, and three other ships of the same size are sinking all around you, I just don't know how you push that out of your mind. And he did the best he could, and I felt like, I don't know if I can keep pushing this guy to recall these memories. And in fact, after that first conversation we had, he couldn't go through with it anymore. He tried, and then we gave up on that. I talked to him about other things, and he had a marvelous full life that needed to be explored. Like, a lot of really a lot of writing has to be more than just one story. And Ernie had several stories to tell. Obviously, the one we're talking about right now, Vincennes and the Battle of Tsavo Island. But, the story of Ernie being a sailor was significant. And And the book goes into Ernie's sailing career and his secrets and how he loved the water and the waves and the weather. We go into that in depth. And his family, because he was one of these greatest generation guys, you know, growing up in the Depression, just fighting for a living. And you have to, like, look at him as a young man who had to fight for everything, and swimming across Canandaigua Lake, falling through the ice on Erie Canal when he's out skating with some pals so that the water hadn't drained that year, and looking up at the ice, seeing that hole, knowing he has to find his way up through the water to that hole on the ice in order to survive. Lessons like that, that's what enabled him to survive when he was faced with his biggest crisis, which was getting off of a sinking, burning ship.
We're going to get to that point, because it's a military story that I didn't know much about, and I suspect most of Jeff's readers do not. And we'll talk about the fact that this is history we should know. We'll get Jeff's insights, his thoughts about why we don't know as much. And I think some of that, at least, is contained in some of the newspaper headline work that Jeff uncovers following that massive naval defeat, which ended up looking like war propaganda and not journalism. We'll get back to that. Really, to me, the core of this story is not just Ernie's story. What Jeff has done is he's given us a gift to really understand so many people in our lives who have served at war and cannot talk about it or suffer from PTSD, diagnosed or undiagnosed, and what that does to their lives. And I'm going to read that quote again that Jeff just referenced. When Ernie told Jeff, "I know why those kids come back from Afghanistan and shoot themselves. You lay awake at night reacting, because it's so real." That is strong, hard stuff to hear, because we've got a really high rate of suicide now among the armed forces. And so this was personal to you. You were his biographer, but you seem to love the guy.
Ernie and I did a lot together. You know, it started out as this thing where we would meet every Monday morning at his house. And he lived right on Lake Ontario. And we'd just sit there underneath this giant tulip tree and go through his life. And like I said, he had a lot of things to talk about in 93 years. But then it became this more this thing. I'd go over to his house and we'd drink some wine together. I would drive him around the city and we'd look at places where he'd lived and worked and things he had seen, recalling the Hindenburg flying over Rochester, things like that. He had a fabulous memory. He could remember the price of hamburgers at the White Tower restaurant, which was over on, I think State Street, maybe.
He would have known.
Yeah, he'd remember.
And I love that, by the way, because Jeff mentions in the book several points where he would drop these facts on you, and you would actually dig through and research, and sure enough, he was on the money.
He was always right, yeah. How much a movie ticket was. You know, he remembered everything. And maybe that was, too, his... one of his issues is that he did remember everything, and when it came to the Vincennes, and I was so concerned that I was awakening this monster in him that I didn't want to be the guy responsible for that. So we moved off in other directions, and I explored that tragedy through other avenues.
So the book is called 22 Minutes, The USS Vincennes and the Tragedy of Savo Island, A Lifetime Survival Story. It's out now, and Jeff's got an event on Thursday evening, 6 p.m.?
Yeah, 6 o'clock, Record Archive, a great band, Our Own Worst Enemy playing, and we'll have the books, and I'll be signing it. You know, if you've ever been in the Record Archive, Baxter Lounge, the Backroom Lounge, it's just a unique venue in Rochester. I think it's the only record store in New York City that sells beer and wine. So it's kind of a little bar-like atmosphere. Nice stage and music.
Music, nice stage. Jeff will be there. Nice having a little glass of wine and talking about this. And this is for all of us. We are losing this generation by the day. But this is for all of us, and I want to appeal directly to listeners. Do you know someone in your life who could not talk about their war experience? Maybe couldn't talk about a tragic event, losing a friend, a particularly intense combat scenario, or just the experience itself of serving that they don't want to talk about? Or have you, you know, what have you experienced from that? Have you been able to get them to open up? Do you want, whether it's a grandfather, a parent, a sibling, a friend, to open up? Do you worry that we hold these war experiences in, as Ernie did? Call the program. It's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Maybe you're one of the few people in the audience who knows a lot about the Vincennes or the tragedy at Savo Island. And why don't more of us know about this? We know Pearl Harbor. So this followed, of course, Pearl Harbor. Ernie was, how old was he at the time here, Jeff?
During the battle?
Yeah.
He was 25, so he was kind of an older sailor.
Yeah, so he's 25 years old. He's a carpenter. Mm-hmm. And the USS Vincennes is what? For those who've never seen it, what was it?
It was a cruiser, which is, in the batting order, it's, you know, one down from the battleships. And it was, had been quite a part of the war up to that point. It had been accompanied the USS Hornet when it went over to Japan in the early stages of the war. They dropped some bombs on Japan just to kind of show them we could reach you. It was Doolittle, Admiral Doolittle, I guess it was his kind of a famous little moment. But and it was a part of several of the other. U-boat wars in the Atlantic, and then they moved over to the Guadalcanal campaign, and that went on for months. And as you said, we kind of wonder why we don't know about the Battle of Savo Island. We don't talk about that like we do Pearl Harbor, which obviously was a defeat for the United States Navy, but something about those stories, or like the Battle of the Bulge, too. We talk about that every year, it seems. There's, we came back from those, and it's a story of resiliency. Those particular things are resiliency. We came back. We came back, too, from Battle of Savo Island. It was a disastrous 22 minutes, and that's where the title of the book comes from. The battle was 22 minutes long. Four ships sunk in 22 minutes. But eventually the United States persevered in the Guadalcanal campaign. But for some reason, you just don't hear about that night. There have been books written about Guadalcanal. But there's a strange, I don't know if I can call it strange, but in recent years, Robert Ballard, people with the capability and the resources to explore the seafloor have been looking at ships that have sunk. Lusitania, Titanic, of course. Ballard did that one. And Ballard went and checked out Savo Island, found a couple of the ships, but not Vincennes. But then a few years ago, expedition headed by Paul Allen, who was another billionaire enthusiast of, he was from co-founder of Microsoft. He led an expedition to Savo Island as well, and they found Vincennes on the bottom there. They found about half of the 50 ships that are on the bottom of Savo Island, which is
why it got the nickname. What's the nickname?
Iron Bottom Sound.
Iron Bottom Sound.
Mm, yeah. So we have this curiosity about these tragedies. We there's no reason to really go down and see these ships sitting on the bottom of the ocean, except for to remind ourselves of how horrible this was. And it's not a morbid thing. It's just kind of like we don't want to leave you down there. I don't know what it is, but there's a real interest in this kind of wreckage or archaeology.
Yeah, the kind of excavation. Mm-hmm. So the battle itself, we're going to talk about in a moment here. And Jeff has such a keen eye for some of these things, just describing the USS Vincennes that the subject of the book, Ernie Coleman, was on. This boat, this vessel, was gorgeous if you forget what it was made for. And, you know, Jeff just has such a great eye to kind of pointing out that, juxtaposing it that way, what man is capable of creating and how fast man is capable of destroying it, which is what happened then. And we'll talk in our second half hour about why don't we know about this. Well, this was considered to be the greatest defeat in a fair fight, essentially a fair fight. We can look at Pearl Harbor and say, we got ambushed. And you can look at other battles and say, well, that was a draw, or we won this one. This one, there was a lot of pride lost here. Mm-hmm. This was a disaster. More than 1,200 people died among the boats that were attacked there, and maybe 50 Japanese died. Mm-hmm. It was a total rout. Not how the papers reported it. We'll get back to that in a moment. But let me grab a couple of phone calls. Jason in Rochester first on the phone with Jeff Spivak. Go ahead, Jason.
Hi, yes. I would just like to talk about a little bit. I know it's not exactly the same thing, but we have capable of creating and how fast man is capable.
Hey, Jason, stay right on your phone there. I couldn't hear you. Go ahead.
Oh, yes. I just wanted to mention my grandfather is now in his 90s, and I know this is not the same thing, but it's basically a story about what war does to the greatest generation, how they're not allowed to talk about it. He was forcibly drafted into the HJ in Germany as a teenager, 15 years old, and he is just now starting to feel that he can, at the twilight years of his life, talk about some of the horrific things that he saw from not just, you know, kids going to the front lines and being killed, like 13, 14-year-olds, and then, you know, the Russian soldiers and people having these Saving Private Ryan moments where you're looking at the enemy soldier and you run away because it's, you know, you're just surviving. And he has all these terrible memories that that generation was never allowed to talk about or just not even acknowledged. And it's a really sad phenomenon. Mm.
Jeff, what do you make of that?
Well, it's a story you hear a lot. And it's not so much maybe not allowed to talk about it, but they don't want to talk about it. And they just move on. And I don't think that's a healthy situation. I'm not a psychologist, but you bury those kinds of things. And Ernie was probably very fortunate that he was able to move on and have a very productive life. But you hear about a lot of people who just don't properly deal with this. And that was, you know, what was happening at that time. You know, as I said, you know, man up, move on, get on with your life.
You and I, neither one of us are psychologists or psychiatrists, but I understand the decision you made as Ernie's biographer to try as lightly and gingerly as you could to see if you could get at this experience. Ernie was a carpenter on the USS Vincennes, which was part of a fleet in the area of Guadalcanal. And yes, there is a confrontation coming with the Japanese. There are people far smarter and more scholarly than I who can understand how somehow all of the warning signs were missed. But the fact remains that the Japanese Navy were able to successfully attack, sink a number of vessels, including the Vincennes. It was in the middle of the night, what, about 1 or 2 a.m.?
Yeah,
something like that.
1 or 2, yeah.
And, you know, the captain gets woken up while everything is on fire. It's a disaster. Ernie is seeing, you know, as best we can tell in the very little accounts we have from Ernie, he's instantly, just as everybody is, hearing bombs go off and, you know, fire and gunfire and people dying around him, wondering, can you save a ship? Mm-hmm. Can you get a few rounds off yourself? Can you fight back against the Japanese? Eventually, they were surrounded. There are conflicting reports about whether certain American ships even fired because they were worried, are we aiming at our own people? Mm-hmm. It was total confusion and disaster. Nothing about it was anything to be proud of on the American side. And yet the initial headlines were, you know, Americans fight off Japanese at Guadalcanal. I mean, it was crazy, the headlines you were pulling.
I went through months of headlines about the war, built on the reporting of correspondents who accompanied the ships but also through, you know, what the Navy said had happened. And the information was just trickled out so slowly. Here we have a huge disaster, and it was months before the American public even heard about it. And, you know, of course, many people didn't know what had happened to their family members on those ships. It eventually came out, I think it was in November. The battle was in August. I think it was in November when the United States Navy said, okay, yeah, we lost three of our ships. This was after the Australians had already said, yeah, we lost one of ours, too. But the secrecy that cloaked these kinds of operations surprised me. I just didn't know that you could keep a tragedy this magnitude quiet for so long.
The idea being that if we tell the full story, well, this helps the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
But your observation was, sure, but if you're deceiving the American public, number one, that's not journalism, and number two, that doesn't help you anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are grieving families that don't understand what happened. A full picture of war, I think, and maybe this is the journalist in me talking, is good for everybody. Understanding what is actually happening at war. Mm-hmm. Not some sort of rah-rah, hey, we routed the Japanese, or, yeah, we lost a boat or two, but we fought them off.
And there was an element of rah-rah in the reporting.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I thought it was appalling.
Yeah.
Did you?
Yeah. Reading the accounts now and seeing how they diverge from the true facts, does that happen today? Oh, I'll bet it does. But maybe in less obvious ways. Mm. But I guess that's our nature to hide these things.
We're going to come back to how Ernie was one of the Americans who got off the Vincennes and survived when so many died. Let me get Linda in Penfield on the phone next. Go ahead, Linda.
Hi. I wanted to share a story about my Uncle Steve, who also fought in the Pacific. And my Uncle Steve was a very happy-go-lucky, positive guy, never had a bad word to say about anybody. And he had retired as a maintenance person from our local high school. And my husband and I were visiting one day, and he picks up this old textbook, and he says to me, "Do you know what they're throwing out? They're throwing out these books." And he opens up to a page that talks about the Battle of Peleliu. And the Battle of Peleliu at that time was the bloodiest first day battle in the Pacific Theater. And he's saying, people need to know about this, and they're throwing this away. And I think that is first time, maybe the only time, I had ever seen my Uncle Steve cry, because I knew nothing about his experience. He was a Marine. I mean, that was the only time
I ever heard about it. Did you say the Battle of Peleliu?
Peleliu, yes.
Yeah, yeah. That was a friend of mine's father was in that battle, and it's mentioned in the book briefly, and that was one of those island-hopping campaigns near the close of the war that, as we look back now, we think, why did we even bother with that? We didn't need that island. You know, we were moving towards Japan. The war was winding down, and a lot of men died for questionable reasons.
Yes. I came to know that particular battle was controversial for that reason. And I had never battled Peleliu. You know, we grew up hearing about all the typical battles. And, you know, it really wasn't until I went to the George Eastman House and they had a photojournalism exhibit and they had some pictures of Peleliu. And that's where I got to see what had happened, and the bodies just floating in the sand that are all shot up. And I can only imagine. That is all I have in my head, you know, is the imagination, because I was not there. And to know my Uncle Steve, he was just the happiest guy, and he had, you know, would play with words and tell a joke, and that is the only time I heard him talk about his war experiences.
Well, do you wish there had been more conversation about the experience? Do you think that would have been helpful, Linda?
Yes, but, you know, my Uncle Steve, he was kind of the old clock. You know, that is just what you did. And the horror of everything that happened, I think what was going through my Uncle Steve's mind is like, I don't ever want to think about that again. I want to get on with my life. I want to, you know, have some kids and just move forward. And if he were here and I were to ask him, I don't know how much more I would get from him. You know, I don't think he would talk about the true terribleness of it, because he was just cut from the old cloth. You know, yeah. I would like to know, because I just like to know stories of my family. It's how to keep the family going, really, is telling the family stories. So, yeah. So I appreciate your taking my call and letting me tell that story about my Uncle Steve.
Linda, thank you. Thank you for listening, and thank you for doing that. And certainly you can hear in Linda's voice, you know, love and respect for family, but also that searching that we all do, trying to figure out, well, should we push someone to talk about it? I agree with Jeff. I said, we're not psychologists. Generally speaking, I don't know a whole lot of situations in life where trained professionals would say, yes, suppress that. That's. But I also understand why people do, and for Ernie, it was sort of a survival mechanism. So at one point in the book, and I can't remember where, Jeff, help me out here, where Ernie is writing about or making notes about his own life, and he had 13 words about this?
Yeah, yeah.
Something like that?
His family gave him a journal to record events of his life, and, you know, he wrote down, you know,
lots of stuff.
A few pages, all kinds of things that happened to him throughout his life. And then he comes to the biggest event of his life, and it's like, you know, was on a ship in World War II, sunk. You know, I believe that was what I was saying. Nothing. And this is the biggest event of his life.
And so you had to make a decision on how hard you wanted to push. Mm-hmm. You had the family urging you be careful.
Yeah, his wife, Marilyn, kind of urged me to shut it down, which I did. And then we tried it again. And again, the nightmares came back, and I thought, okay, that's it. I can't push this guy any further on this. And we moved on to his life, and like I said, he was a multifaceted fellow. He had a lot of things to talk about. He was married four times to his wife's died tragically. When he talked about World War II, he would talk about it in terms of when he was, after the Battle of Savo Island, he was stationed at Pearl Harbor, and as a carpenter was involved in a lot of maintenance. And they ran it like, if you ever remember McHale's Navy, the old television show, the old comedy. It was like that. It had that ring of, some sailors scamming their way through the war. And Ernie was that kind of a guy throughout his life. He's a little bit of a scamp. He was a fun man. He was an adventurous man. He loved to dance. He was the life of any party. And he was a serious guy when it came to building a family, because he and his second wife adopted a child. Then she passed away. His wife passed away. And he remarried and added, four or five more kids to the family. She passed away, his wife passed away again. And he remarried again and added a couple more kids. So I think he ended up with seven stepkids and all, adopted kids and stepkids. And they all went in interesting, diverse ways. Some of them, lives of, one worked for Kodak for years. Another one, tragically, had a difficult time dealing with her her father after he found out that she was gay, and Ernie eventually resolve that situation.
There was a beautiful little reconciliation.
Yeah, yeah, that's one of my favorite chapters in the book, actually. But yeah, and I talked to her. I talked to all the family members, and I talked to her, and her story is quite harrowing, and the reconciliation, I think, was kind of a nice little thing, but it's still. It's rough, you know. Some of the family members had it rough, you know, and one of them, you know, was clearly an alcoholic who passed away from cancer. And Ernie did his best to meld this family. It basically, you know, a set of, you know, kids coming from three different directions: his own adopted daughter, his second wife's kids, and his third wife's kids, and his fourth wife's kids. So he put all this together, and not an easy job.
Ernie passed away, and we can only speculate how the suppression of those memories might have impacted him over his life. Certainly, in some ways, it served him well. He was able to accomplish a lot in his life, and he reinvented himself a lot. And Jeff's book details the invention and the reinvention and the survival instincts that this man had, whether it was work, family life, being at sea, all kinds of scenarios. But you do wonder. You really do. And the story is a beautiful and an important one. And in many ways, I will also say, this felt book of less than 200 pages will make you laugh. There's a lot of really enjoyable aspects. It's a vivid biography. It's called 22 Minutes, The USS Vincennes and the Tragedy of Savo Island, a lifetime survival story. XXI does not endorse just about anything but ourselves, that's what we do. And in fact, tomorrow you should wake up early with me and become a member of WXXI. But I will say this, if you care about good writing and good journalism, you ought to buy Jeff's book. It's called 22 Minutes. Where can you get it now, Jeff?
It's on Amazon. I believe it'll be in the Barnes & Nobles and your usual book places. And you can get it Thursday at Record Archive.
6 o'clock, Jeff will be at Record Archive for a fun little party with music, some wine, and books there. So if you or someone you know served at war, and you've got stories to share, and you want to understand our common humanity better, which is only about just about all of us, you ought to be there on Thursday, and you ought to pick up this book and maybe read it yourself or give it as a gift. I'm going to get back to your phone call, so Bob will come to you next year. Let's get our only break of the hour, and we'll come back with more of the remarkable stories of Ernie Coleman, the stories of so many Americans bound up in this one book, 22 Minutes. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections, the Irondequoit Police Department is working to improve the diversity within its ranks. We'll discuss their efforts and how having more officers of color can impact policing and police-community relations. In our second hour, Pulitzer Prize-winning author Jared Diamond is coming to Rochester to discuss his new book, Upheaval: Turning Points for Nations in Crisis. We'll talk about why some countries thrive after great turbulence while others struggle. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. The official tally of military personnel killed at Pearl Harbor, 2,335. The official tally of military personnel killed at Savo Island, something like 1,250, Jeff Spivak. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's more than half of what we lost at Pearl Harbor. Just about every American knows the story of Pearl Harbor. Very few know the story of Savo Island. It's just a very, very strange juxtaposition. Before I get Bob's call in Lima, hang there for one more second, Bob. Part of me thinks that's because we as a country, especially in times of war, there's a very human instinct, probably even journalists have it, to root for the home team. This was a huge loss that, number one, came at a time when the military was very slowly admitting what happened. It was very little details and spin. It was a victory. Then it was sort of a standstill and fighting off the Japanese. And then slowly, months later, the real story. And so maybe that was part of it. And it was also in the midst of a campaign where this was technically a fair fight and the Americans got crushed. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that the Americans throughout history sort of own up to some of that very well. What do you think?
Well, you know, of course you could say, well, events happened so quickly that it was easy to move on to the next episode. And, then there were several naval battles in the course of the Guadalcanal campaign that were successful for the Americans. This particular one, there's nothing to find to celebrate except for the gallantry of the sailors on these ships that were sunk. The incompetence that led to this disaster is a little mind-boggling. the fact that a fleet of Japanese ships could sneak up on the American ships, who even as they were being fired upon, thought that this was a friendly fire situation, and those couldn't be the Japanese. Those must be our guys. We're a little mixed up here. And the fact that they even had spotted the Japanese fleet coming towards them
the previous afternoon.
Before, yeah. That information wasn't passed on. It's kind of an inexcusable series of you know things that were overlooked that it just should not have happened, and perhaps the outcome would have been different. I don't know, but the fleets were evenly matched as far as numbers. It's just the decisions made leading up to the battle, and then during the battle. Are very hard to excuse. It was a lot of incompetence.
What must Ernie have experienced, even though he could never bring himself to talk about it with his biographer, Jeff Spivak? We'll get to that in a moment. Here's Bob and Lima on the phone next. Go ahead, Bob. Hi, Bob. Go ahead.
Yes, are you there, Evan?
Yeah, go ahead, please.
I don't want to take away from the subject of your guest in the World War II focus, but... I wanted to share an experience that I've had as a result of your doing the little theater event a year and a half ago when I got to talk to Ginny Nguyen and her mother with regard to the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of released an interest of mine. I'd been in Vietnam. I came back in 1970 from Vietnam, and most of the time, all the memorabilia and a lot of the memories were stored in a box up high on the shelf marked Vietnam. And I had an audio tape that your staff helped me digitize so that I could share it as an interesting account of ground combat and air support and support from other staff there. It was an interesting account, and it's kind of started me to release a lot of the stories and feelings that I have. I as a result of that, I connected with actually another combatant in my battalion who is an accomplished author, and he's published that audio tape and a couple other stories that I got off my chest a little bit. And I can relate to what Ernie was, why Ernie hadn't told some of those stories or made them generally available, but I commend your guest for interviewing him that way and giving him that opportunity. I think he probably felt very good about it.
Yeah, thank you for that, Bob. I mean, Jeff Spivak ultimately decided that Ernie had to be the one to decide, and he was going to respect that space, and he still tells the story of the Vincennes through his own research, the work of understanding what the headlines said, how those evolved over time, and the short conversations Ernie had with friends that Jeff was able to sort of reconstruct a little bit of. What else would you say to Bobby? There's a lot there.
Well, there was one dramatic incident that Ernie where Ernie shed light on what happened, and it was at a Thanksgiving dinner with his family in 2008. And one of his stepsons was saying to him, Dad, what'd you do in the war? You must have done something. And they pestered him enough that he finally said, okay, you know what? If I tell you what happened, I never want to be asked about this again. So that's where we get a lot of the clues for what actually happened. And it was harrowing. And it is a kind of, add up what he said with other accounts, and you get a picture of one of the most horrific scenes you can imagine. And
describe it as best you can, Jeff.
Well, okay. Like I said, this battle was only 22 minutes long. The Japanese came upon the American ships unseen, and they
middle of the night, right?
In the middle of the night, and you described the Vincennes as kind of a pretty-looking little ship, and it kind of was in a way, but There were some aspects of it that were trouble. Like a lot of ships of that day, they carried aircraft on for reconnaissance. And the first shells from the Japanese Navy hit the Vincennes right where those planes were, which is also the carpenter shop where Ernie was stationed, although Ernie was down below at the time. And all that aviation fuel went up, and before long you had four ships on fire and sinking. And at that point, all of the ship's functions are quitting because, the power is gone. You can't fight the fires. They're raging. Japanese were using shells that were timed so that they would penetrate the ships and explode inside the ship, which created even worse carnage.
Oh, that was a detail that I thought was particularly ghastly.
Yeah. So you're fighting an enemy who you don't know where they are because it's dark. The Japanese aren't even using searchlights. Well, they're putting searchlights on the ships, but by the time they're on fire, you don't need them. And as the Japanese admiral who led the attack observed, the Americans were gallant and fighting back, but there wasn't much they could do. And Ernie is picking his way through the debris of the ship and the bodies to get on deck. He's wounded. They try to put a life jacket on him. He wouldn't do it because he's looking out at the sea and it's all on fire from flaming oil. And he didn't know at the time, but the shark's out there too. And he decides he's going to do something that he had learned to do from when he was a child, swimming across lakes and testing himself all the time, which is he didn't want the life jacket. He just dove into the water. He swam below the flaming oil, came up on the other side, and most of the men there floated for 7 to 8 hours before they were finally picked up. And that was a story that Ernie told to his family at Thanksgiving dinner. And it was the last time he spoke of it, except for various fragments that were almost unrelated, because he, I talked to one of the guys he sailed with, and he remembered Ernie talking about being on the aircraft carrier Saratoga, and this sailor friend of Ernie's thought that Ernie had been on a member of that crew. Well, no, that was the ship that was taking Ernie back to Hawaii after the battle, and this sailor said, well, that's funny. Ernie never mentioned Vincennes. Guy didn't even know that Ernie was on that ship. So when he talked about the war, he gave you a little piece maybe, but not much.
He was that way throughout his life. He would go throughout his life, and he had these relationships, and people would never know that he was on that ship.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That's how he wanted it.
Mm-hmm.
Do we know, once he hit shore, what had happened to them at that point? How he got to the daylight hours? I guess we don't.
Yeah,
know.
Well, no, but he was hospitalized on board of Saratoga for a while. And when it was a month before he got back to Hawaii after the battle, and then he was stationed as a carpenter there, and had several interesting adventures while he was there too, including going AWOL and flying back to the United States for a weekend jaunt on board a Air Force plane, or Naval Air Force plane. And he rebuilt his life. He was a strong man. He was a strong man physically. He was a strong man mentally. And for a guy like him to still be haunted by these kinds of things after all this time just tells you how powerful these episodes can be.
Don't let me misquote him, but I recall toward the end him saying something along the lines of, that there will something that kind of says there will always be war. Did he feel that way? That sort of the condition of man?
Yeah. Ernie didn't really involve himself in politics, and you know, he lived his life as a carpenter and a man, as I said, a man who loved to dance and sail. But yeah, he had a bleak view on that situation. He'd lived it. He'd seen it. I'm sure he understood how so much of what he witnessed could have been avoided. And I think, actually, who among us can say that we're never going to be without war?
Well, that's kind of where I wanted to kind of start to close this conversation with you, because it's not a political book. And Ernie, as you say, was not a political person. You mentioned that for every comment that he made that from your perspective might have been gleaned from Fox News, he also could push left at times. Mm-hmm. And some of that concern about overextension of war or endless war, what's happening in Afghanistan, that he would make those remarks. So he was more complex than just a caricature, for sure. But I do want to ask you if you feel despair about the state of man. Because I think of all the interesting juxtapositions you have in this book and beauty against the backdrop of war, the Vincennes, just the title of this book, the work, the engineering, the brilliance that goes into creating something like that and how fast we can destroy it says a lot about man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the unfortunate thing about the war, World War II in particular, but even if you look back to World War I, these were the wars where technology was racing so quickly that the instruments of war were being bypassed by new instruments of war that could easily destroy what was out there. And that's what happened. That's what's been happening. The technology is beyond what a human can endure. When you're a human being trapped on board a sinking ship that's on fire, it's unimaginable. You're watching the steel literally burn. The paint that you... Ernie was a carpenter. He painted the Vincennes. That was one of his duties. Yeah, the paint you'd put on a couple of days ago is adding to the horror of what's happening out there. So we're never, I don't see how we're ever going to be in a position where the technology isn't going to be there to make peace improbable. A couple of years after Ernie's, after the Battle of Savo Island, we dropped two bombs on Japan that wiped out two cities. I'm among the people who think that that shouldn't have been done because it was not necessary. That war was over. But that was done. We've seen other horrors of war that not only now make it impossible for soldiers to, and sailors to survive, but citizens to survive. It's total war now, and nobody can escape it. And we just seem to want to keep using these things.
It was after 9/11, and I remember a family friend making a particularly crude remark, saying, "If we see one more 9/11-like attack, this country will go pave the Middle East. That we will drop enough in the way of bombing, even nuclear devices." And I remember even then thinking, and what does that solve? What does that deliver us? I guess the only hope is that our technology is now so powerful that mankind will have a collective breath catching to say, we can't risk that. But it only takes one time, and that's what worries me. I think books like yours are reminders of the beauty and the destruction we create, and I think that's actually really useful.
Yeah, that dichotomy of beauty. You know, Ernie loved sailing on Lake Ontario. He thought Lake Ontario was the most beautiful place he'd ever seen. That dichotomy of that beauty and the horror that he witnessed on the other side of the world, on the ocean, is, to me, it's a reminder of how fragile it is, how fragile our coexistence on this planet is, that we can have the beauty and the horror in the blink of a generation. It just, it's, why don't we learn? Why don't we learn? And we don't.
I really, truly do believe that books like this, though, are important works. And I want to thank you for taking the time to write it. And I hope our listeners will see Jeff on Thursday night, 6 o'clock at the Record Archive, for some music. And actually a good time, believe it or not. We talked about some heavy stuff this
hour.
We're
celebrating.
Yeah, you should be celebrating. The book's called 22 Minutes, The USS Vincennes and the Tragedy of Savo Island, A Lifetime Survival Story. Jeff Spivak's new book, A Svelte Read. It's out now, and I hope you find it. You're laughing at svelte.
It's to the point.
Well, you know.
Yeah.
I'm being direct here.
Got
just
right
as you are.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Evan.
Our thanks to David Griffin volunteering today, and Rob Braden is the engineer. Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a wonderful afternoon, and we'll talk to you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.